Sandbaggers, dirtbaggers, and douchebags and dipshits. You have reached the Real War Project. My name is Charles Horgan. I am a Purple Heart veteran, and I am here with my bestest of pals, Dr. Aaron Donaldson.
What am I gonna do? I can't survive.
Hi, Charles. I'm a sandbagger. I'm pretty sure that's where I fit in.
Heck yeah.
You would know better than I.
Sandbagger is kind of like a quiet quitter these days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You just carry me around. I'm just dead weight. But if a flood comes along,
hey,
who are you looking for?
Exactly.
All right. I don't know how that works. Good to see you, Charles. This is batch 13 of the Real War Project. If I'm not mistaken, 39 movies here. Last batch was called You Are Already Dead. And we watched Patton, 12 O'Clock High, and The Admiral Roaring Currents, 1970, 1949, 2014. Those batches are definitely speaking to this one, in my opinion. I'm calling this batch a natural leader. I don't know what your thoughts are, but we watched Master and Commander, Far Side of the World.
A man would follow you anywhere. As a friend, I would say that we should have turned back weeks ago.
It's leadership they want. Strength. Find that within yourself, and you will earn their respect.
Captain Horatio Hornblower.
We'll load with chain shot. I want those four Frenchmen dismasted. We'll close to point blank range and take them in succession.
And Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
There she is.
Shield collapsing, Captain.
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
What are your thoughts on the batch title? How am I doing? A natural leader? Is that...
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah. When I put the batch together, it was boat action.
Boat action. Got it.
Pretty vague. But as it went along, it was like, wow, this is just really similar. This has been a surprising batch for me. I was expecting to just really love Master and Commander. And, you know, I still do.
Uh-huh.
because you're getting to see, like, I mean, it's really a pretty solid movie, but when you watch it back to back with Horatio Hornblower, you see how little has changed.
Yeah.
Aside from just the effects and cool THX sound and stuff.
The sound is visceral and significant. I think the music works really well in that movie. I think obviously the effects and things we said for sure. But the other thing that changed that we noticed was that like we care less about young children dying at war, apparently.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it was alarming. It's a little concerning that the 2014 movie is like, this boy is going to lose his arm and be called the bravest patient that we've ever seen and lead a boarding party onto the ship at the end.
And you were going to cheer for him.
The whole time.
Yeah.
And, you know, Captain Horatio Hornblower isn't like, you know, Beasts of No Nation when we had our batch on child soldiers. That came out at like the same year as Master and Commander, pretty close to it anyway. As we said way back then, these movies look at child soldiers very differently. and it doesn't improve.
Yeah. It's wild because Horatio Hornblower didn't go all the way with how young that person is.
No.
You know, like we said, like he could be either 13 or 30.
Right.
It's hard to tell, but he is supposed to look youthful.
Yeah, the midshipman could be as young as 11, we learned. Yeah.
Good God, yeah.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he has any moment at all where he's acknowledging how sad it is,
yeah,
is surprising because I don't feel like Aubrey had a moment where he was sad about the younger. Like, I know that he's like an officer and he's supposed to hide it, but
he gives him the book.
You know, we get to hang out with him behind the door. So
it's when he's in the hammock and it's after his arm's been cut off and he hands him the book, and we get this cut to him where he kind of, to me, Russell Crowe takes this moment where he's like, he's too young, he's like, it's just like he seems a little overwhelmed, and he takes a little breath and then he just tells him about Nelson and the heroism, and that's about it. That's the only moment that we have. But the resolution for this character is like he buckles some swash at the end and the movie's like, yay! Yeah.
And he kind of like, I don't feel like there's a moment at the end where he's like, it is pretty sad that I lost these guys and some of them are super freaking young. Like, I just don't feel like he has that moment. He's like, no, turn the fucking ship around. We got a guy to capture.
Or where this kid has an Agu moment where he's sitting there like, everyone is talking to me like I am a child, but I am a man and I have seen the world. Like, no, this kid is like not through the nose. He's a boy, but he's a boy soldier and he's a good one. He's the bravest patient ever, even though his arm gets cut off. No sawing sounds. Here again, we will say the effects are better. But are they more realistic?
Uh-huh.
They're very sterilized, that we said. Like, the explosions look explodey, but they don't look as mortal,
uh-huh,
as they should. And the things falling in Horatio Hornblower, we said, looked crushing.
Yeah.
Like, that just looked crushing. It looked like people could get crushed in those moments. And with Master and Commander, the huge bursts of interior explosion and shards of wood and things, like, that all looked fine, but it didn't seem mortal. We said that Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan was like bloodier.
Yeah.
Get that one in the conversation here, right? Because that's another one where you would think it would be campier. It might be like fanciful if people are thinking it's a sci-fi movie. But it is a much like clearer-eyed look at just like the consequences of like leadership and things than Master and Commander is by far.
Yeah. Kirk seems to beat himself up more than Aubrey ever did for the other ship getting the drop on him.
Yeah.
Kirk has that moment where Scotty does most of the emoting, you know, but Kirk supports his friend, you know, and he feels his pain. And he is there to witness the consequences of what's happened.
Right.
So what the hell happened? What the hell happened in the 20 years after Star Trek II came out?
Kirk gets a bloody handprint on his bib.
Yeah, to remind him forever.
And this kid does not have a hand to leave a handprint,
yeah,
on Aubrey's bib because his arm was amputated. But don't worry.
I've never seen a braver patient.
We feel a lot better about it in 2014 or whatever than we did in 1982. And even Horatio Hornblower was, I don't have it here. Why don't I have it? 1951? 1951.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's unforgivable because also Master and Commander comes out post Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
So there is a standard that's expected of a war movie violence, but this movie kind of has the feeling of a post Saving Private Ryan movie. Like, it's desaturated, I feel like, at points,
yep,
especially in comparison to Horatio Hornblower, which is in a magical world.
Yeah, the better than real life Technicolor compared to whatever it is that's going on in the coloration and lighting of this movie, they're so different.
Mm-hmm.
The invocation of Saving Private Ryan, I think of Eli, I can't remember which episode it was, making fun of the explosion and then the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we get some of that too.
But in Saving Private Ryan, I feel like there's literally water with blood in it streaming down Hanks's face.
Yes.
While he's staring at a man screaming, "What the hell do we do now, sir?"
I said, "What the hell do we do now, sir?"
And here it is just Aubrey looking around at feet and figuring himself out, and then he's right back in the fight. And it's like, ting, 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 and off he goes.
Right.
And it's like, oh, okay. That's not so bad.
For something that is a form of combat that must create the most grotesque of wounds.
Yes.
And where it's like not even outright killing people, just splinters and bodies,
right.
and bodies getting...
The sliver coming out of Aubrey's neck ain't nice,
yeah.
But it's also not right.
Right, no. did you ever see that movie, The Way of the Gun?
No.
I think Taye Diggs is in it, maybe. But also Ryan Phillippe. Well, there's a scene in there during the big shootout at the end where Ryan Phillippe jumps into an empty... They're like in an... like a dusty old town, and he jumps into a fountain, and when he jumps into the fountain he realizes that people have just been drinking beers and just chucking the bottles into the fountain.
Oh god.
And so he like jumps in there, and then the next shot you see him going ah, and he just has this huge shard of bottle underneath his skin, and he's like like falling out.
Oh god.
There's nothing of that. There's the splinter that he pulls out of his thing. We see splinters go, but the guys are always out of frame. Even if Paul Bettany, if he just kind of imply from the motion that he's got to work through it, through this
right.
kid's arm, and that it's a gross thing to have to do, as opposed to what it seems like he's doing, which is like cutting spam.
Right.
Yeah.
The bone saw combination is so visceral and so affective that, like, that seems like a no-brainer of a moment. We do have some blood and guts moments, very literally, when Bettany is pulling the bullet out of his own stomach, which is grim and, like, wow, but also a kind of very independent masculine hero moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we've picked up in the Siege of Jadoville, pulling the bullet out and plunking it in the tray. And I thought that was a very fun conversation that we could invoke right here for Bettany's moment to be like, but is this real, like, real war blood? Like, no, I feel like it's...
Because it's more of a moment about what a great doctor he is and that he's super tough.
Yes, exactly. And how, like, stoic he is and all of this. And Aubrey is looking away and all of this. And then at the very beginning, you do very briefly see, like, sand on the floor in a couple of moments, right? But when they find the people that Khan left behind in Star Trek II Wrath of Khan, I said that there's moments in that movie that I feel like they're very... explicitly evoking Alien, the things in the ear. Here's a good one. Here's a great moment where that right there was way scarier than large shards of wood that have been blown apart in your face. Like,
this, I mean, they're throwing grenades in there that just look like balls of iron with a fuse coming out of it.
Right.
And so it's like, you should see at some point, like, people slipping on the deck because it's gross up there.
For the listener that may be a little uncertain, it isn't that we need these things to have a more entertaining moment. Part of the conversation that we try to have again and again is, how do you render combat so that it's entertaining but not sterile, and that it doesn't desensitize it and make everyone want to be a soldier? One thing you've said a lot, Charles, is like, when we watch these movies, we think to ourselves, if only there was one more. And then the hero looks at the crowd and it's like, is that you? And it's like, if only I were there, I could help win that fight. And if we're being honest about war, we don't want that.
Right.
And definitely not for an 11-year-old to be seeing this movie and enjoying it as much as they can, because it is enjoyable. Master and Commander is a good-looking, good-sounding, well-cast, like, well-written. It's based on some incredible books, and they do a very good job. They strip Mature, and I have a little bit more on this later, we said. But otherwise, like, Killick looks great in there, I said. There's so many characters. Mr. Pullings, we said. I could just go on and on. But the lesson is wrong. The lesson is that this is awesome and fun.
Yeah. It's hard, but if you can tough it out, you're the toughest of the tough.
Yeah.
Cool.
We talked about the Berkenstein chapter 6 from the book Reframing 9/11, Film, Popular Culture, and the War on Terror. And they talked about how popular Master and Commander was with conservatives because of the kind of leadership we get. This is who George W. Bush was trying to be. This movie was made before 9/11, but it takes it to the French. We said, like, it was, it's, I don't know that it is setting out to be this kind of conservative propaganda, but dang, it just puts all the pieces in motion. Mm-hmm. And as you said at the very top of this bit, it was a very surprising lesson in this segment.
Yeah.
That really only critical viewing is going to give you. It's like you got to put the criticism hat on and ask these questions. How does this movie look at child soldiers?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I expected of Captain Horatio Hornblower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's something even just about the title of the movie.
It sounds like it was made in 1951, doesn't it?
Right. When I was a little kid and I heard the name Horatio Hornblower, like I thought it was a joke. Like
it's really hard not to make fun of it.
it's truly a bizarre name.
I sent you a lot of texts.
Yeah. With the exception of updated sound and special effects, the movies are really super comparable.
How derivative is Master and Commander? That's
the other thing. Yeah. Where, you know, it's like where we eventually, you know, we will watch Saving Private Ryan. So just keep subscribing.
Someday.
Someday. But it's like you can watch Saving Private Ryan and Big Parade.
Yeah.
And be like, okay, yeah, it's a buddy squad movie. Like, what's changed? Oh, we can show more gore. Like, we know how to do effects now and how to hook up squibs without actually putting, like, a piece of dynamite in somebody's clothes.
Right. Or you could watch, you said, Dr. Strangelove. You could watch that one and be, like, the shot from behind the helmets and all of this. Like, that's very evocative and okay.
Right. And so it's like, that's why my older sister doesn't like Saving Private Ryan, because to her, it just feels derivative and that she's being punished for watching it as well.
Yeah, it is punishing.
Yeah, it definitely is. But the biggest sin is that it doesn't have anything really more to say than Big Parade. And Big Parade was one of the first.
I feel like even Big Parade is more thoughtful. When you get to the end of that movie, Johnny Appleseed, Johnny Ampersand, like that guy is sullen, that guy is unhappy, that guy's kind of bitter.
He doesn't fit in with his family anymore whatsoever.
Right. Yes. And Saving Private Ryan leaves us with Earn This.
James. Earn This.
And he did, apparently. You're a good man. Look at your big family. They're all white.
Tell me I have led a good life.
What?
Tell me I'm a good man.
You are.
And there's so many ways to read Earn This. It is literally the movie looking to every child in the audience and being like, you might need to suit up and you might need to earn this. And by the way, there's a game that lets you be a paratrooper in the 101st into Normandy. And if we're serious, it's like, no, thank you. I don't want to do that. But if you watch Band of Brothers, which is a genealogical connection to Saving Private Ryan, that's where we learned. And Master and Commander is even gauzier.
It doesn't have the ugly to it.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't say earn this. It says the war is never over. And that's fun. When they realize that the French duped them and that the captain's still alive on that ship and that they just sent, you know, Captain Pullings with his first skeleton crew and a bunch of people in the prison off, like, they turn around, but the music goes...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like the Longest Day stuff. They're whistling their way off the beach at the end of the Longest Day. And this movie's like, hey, we fight the war forever. What are you going to do? I don't like it. But I love the movie. And that's part of what we're here to do, is to figure out, like, what are we learning when we watch movies that we love?
Yeah, biggest surprise was that I actually kind of really loved Horatio Hornblower.
Yeah.
It's like I enjoyed the shit out of it.
Yeah, I expected to like Wrath of Khan the first time I saw it. If you listen to the Alien Movie Project episode, I enjoyed it. I wanted to watch Captain Horatio Hornblower because it was a boat action movie, and you and I love these things.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a good turtle ship episode last batch that's worth going to listen to.
Yeah.
But I was like, this movie's going to be work. This movie is going to be work. And it was not. I mean, again, Gregory Peck, great. Love watching the guy. the miniatures in that are very, very good.
Uh-huh.
The fact that the story is so influential in the imagination of so many of these other movies that we watch means that this is, if not the first time, one of the more influential times that we're seeing a lot of these shapes.
The movie knows its tone. And it stays there.
Yep.
And Master and Commander like wants to have it both ways. Like it wants to have like the jolly lark, but also it wants to trick you into thinking that it's a hardcore portrayal of what that is like.
A big quote's real war movie, huh?
Yeah.
Freaking interesting. I made a comparison of the three captains for the natural leader. We don't have to go through all of it. But one of the things that is interesting to me is when I was looking at like the number two. Does Horatio Hornblower have a number two? Because with Aubrey, it's Maturin, who is Paul Bettany's character. And he is very limited and very stripped in the movie. But he's still a buddy. He's still a mentor. He's still a voice of conscience that pushes back on Aubrey at key moments that are stripped down. In the book, it's deep. These two are very like integral, reliant on each other constantly. They hate each other. They need each other kind of thing. With Kirk, we get Spock and Bones in Wrath of Khan, we said, which is like logic and emotion. And then if you look throughout the franchise, like the whole point is like there's a bridge of people that are like, and they've all got a crew. But like Uhura has a much bigger role in Star Trek than like anyone in any of these other movies that we're talking about.
Right.
And yeah, she's a switchboard operator, and that's, you know, not a lot. But, you know, when we look at Wrath of Khan, we see Savick or whatever, right? Like
Savick, yeah.
Savick, there it is. And my point is simply that Hornblower is like on an island. Mm-hmm. He's all by himself. There's no number two in that one that I could see. I don't know about the series, but
yeah, no, I don't know either. But I imagine that the number two to Hornblower is that lady that he fell in love with. She can look forward to 15 years of marriage and 15 months of actually getting to see him.
Listen, if he's an abuser or a loud snorer, like that could work out really well. I don't know. Lady Barbara Wellesley? Yeah, Virginia Mayo is Lady Barbara. She's a voice of conscience at times. She's a romantic love interest for sure. But, you know, in terms of like Master and Commander, there's just nothing. Like Sophie, we see Sophie's name in a letter, Master and Commander, and that's it. And if you read the books, it's like, that's weird. There could be a lot more of Sophie in this movie. Okay.
And this lady also, she does the, she takes up the Paul Bettany role when the doctor dies.
Yeah.
Which is wild because the doctor kind of has a big part considering up to that point. And then you're like, oh, damn, he just died off screen.
Right. You think she's down there like sawing the arms off of 11-year-olds just with like
probably and then she says, bring me the next 11-year-old.
He's fine, I just bring him in here.
I don't care.
Master and Commander for Aubrey, he says, for England, for home, and for the prize. For Horatio Hornblower, I think they don't say it, but it is very, very explicitly implied, for England and also the prize. There's some prize in Hornblower, but they give it up.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And they lament giving it up, but they're like, ah, we'll get the next one. You know, so there is prize stuff going on, but it's not like Master and Commander. And then I just love this. Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, to boldly go where no one has gone before. This is so different. This makes me think of a book I'm going to wave at Charles because I like waving books at things. Here's a book by Kenneth Burke, and it's got little film strips here on the side, which is why it's very important to this project for me. The book is called Language and Symbolic Action by Kenneth Burke, and he talks about terministic screens. Metaphors are like mining screens with different like gradients of thickness. And so if I call you an opponent, that's a screen. If I call you an enemy, that's a different screen, but they overlap in some ways. If I call you a criminal, these are three screens we could lap on top of each other, right? Anyway, I just think it's interesting that for Aubrey, it's for England, for home, and for the prize. We could talk about colonialism. We could talk about settler colonialism. We could talk about mercantile capitalism and how all of these things are just all wrapped up together, having a blast on the high seas. And for Horatio Hornblower, it's very much the same. And to boldly go where no one has gone before, there's a lot on how there is still very colonial, settler colonial mindsets inherent there. But the spirit is one of discovery, at least, which is significantly better.
Yeah, there's a spirit of discovery. The big issue with the Genesis Project, aside from the weird ethical issue of whether or not you should even wield that.
There's a lot of colonial and settler colonial overtones in Star Trek. We're not trying to erase that.
but they are looking for a planet where they wouldn't be disturbing any life.
Just minimize that impact as much as they do have that prime directive, right?
If something is there, then they're supposed to pretty much leave it be and develop on it on its own. And what I also like about Star Trek is that Star Trek 2 posits that there is a different reality in which Kirk checked up on Khan.
Right.
And before everybody got their fucking brains eaten by the bugs and had to live in a windy desert hellscape.
It's very scary.
And how weird would that have been?
Yeah.
If Khan was just like
a member of the crew.
Oh yeah, no, totally. After a while he falls in love, it works out so well for him that he's like, well, maybe I'll get back to Starfleet.
Yeah. It's so interesting how Star Trek, we've talked before when we talked about the crew of specialists in Batch 10, how Star Trek is very militarist, but what we love about it is that it's running from that. Mm-hmm. It's trying really hard to find these alternatives. And I think that when it comes to Star Trek, we get a lot more collaboration. I do think it's interesting that Kirk is constantly framed as a kind of rebel, right? That's kind of like his brand, is that he cheated the test and all this other stuff. Hornblower and Aubrey, I read as very by the book. I think both of these people are very, very by the book.
Mm-hmm.
So Aubrey has Killick. Killick is Aubrey's steward who brings the pudding in, who yells at him for the ink on the tablecloth. Mm-hmm. He pats it, right? Killick is one of my favorite characters, but he is very much like the, quote, simpleton. He's there to be kind of dumb, and that by comparison makes literally everyone look smarter, but very much as the offset to the leader, it's part of that masculine comparison that we talk about a lot when it comes to building masculinity and representative things like cinema. With Hornblower, this person I don't think has a name, but there's a moment early where he comes out and he gives him like his coat or something, mm-hmm. and he like licks his finger and like looks up, and there's just all of this like clown moments where it's very clear this guy could not sail to save his life. He doesn't know what's going on. He is just there to take care of the captain.
Yeah.
Here again, Kirk does not have this. You know, there's no dum-dum in Starfleet. There's no one there that is there to be the dummy to make the other people look smart by comparison, at least not so far as I can see. I'm sure there's like implications and inferences we could make in terms of like racialized aliens and things. But you get the pure reason from Spock, which is arguably the inverse of this. I don't know. Maybe that's interesting, right? Where instead of being the dopey, silly, know-nothing, we get the like...
He knows way too much.
Yeah. Yeah. All he knows is the facts. And he doesn't have any feelings, Charles.
Yeah. I'm constantly delighted by Star Trek.
Same.
Yeah. Yeah. And being re-delighted by it. Like rewatching it in a... in this new context was super fun for me.
Yeah.
It's a movie that I've seen a million times, and I wasn't also going to pick it for this batch because really I wanted to watch the prequel to The Admiral.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's what I wanted to see. I just wanted to see like three different boat, old timey boat action. But once we watched Horatio Hornblower and I was like, oh my God, Master and Commander and Horatio Hornblower are shockingly similar, and Star Trek has, I mean, aside from just the sci-fi thing where they're like, oh, let's take this conundrum and put it in space,
right?
They take the trappings of the ship-to-ship combat, which seems very similar. Like we do see the ships actually passing each other slowly,
right?
And do like broadsides on
like
each
raking
other.
Shots. Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
The interior explosions look very similar.
Yeah, it's just more sparks, right?
Like, yeah.
So we see that, but Star Trek takes a different approach to it. Like they're not out there to go and look for some action. They're not out there trolling for ships to shoot down.
Right.
They're just out there training some people because they do science.
Yeah.
And then it turns out that because of this mistake that he made in the past, you know, that comes back to haunt him. Not Khan, I mean his son.
Right.
And so it's Horatio Hornblower and Master and Commander don't imagine a world that doesn't exist without war.
And those guys don't make they make mistakes. They get the drop on him. Master and Commander, he's like, this is the second time he's done this to me. There will not be a third.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they get beat on the chessboard.
But Paul Bettany doesn't die.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Paul Bettany doesn't sacrifice himself for the sake of the crew.
It would have been so interesting to watch the prequel to The Admiral. Last batch, you are already dead. Patton, 12 o'clock high, and the Admiral roaring currents. And I wanted to bring old Patton into this batch and talk about a natural leader.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think he is one. And I think he's like halfway there. And then the other half is just a liability.
Yeah.
So we can't put this guy in charge of a ship.
Absolute maniac.
But when it comes to old Savage there in 12 o'clock high, I don't know that there is a lot of you're a natural leader. He fights like you, Jack. You're the guy. I'd have to go back and watch. And then Yisun Shin, he would be a very interesting one to bring into this conversation. And I found myself wanting to watch that movie that way. And that's what's kind of fun about the whole critical project that we're doing, besides just watching movies to talk about them, which is great. It's this kind of cross-title comparison with critical perspectives that we're taking to be like, what does this tell us about leadership versus sacrifice? And you can ask those questions at the same time, but it's hard to ask all the questions at once. So,
yeah.
You got to pick, and I'm glad Trek showed up here.
Gregory Peck in 12 o'clock high, he really takes it the hardest of everybody, right? It literally breaks him.
Dude needs a nap at the end of that movie. He's sleepy. Could have been worse. I think it probably was worse. I think I remember reading it was worse. With Trek, they fought those battle sequences. The idea that there was a quote dogfight in Star Trek was something they fought over.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, we said, because Nicholas Meyer, whoever the director, was like, this is Horatio Hornblower in space. And so obviously, if that's the recipe, we ought to be able to be like, yes, there are connections and you can see them. But that was antithetical to Trek in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And that's, Roddenberry was clear about that, and that he didn't want those trappings. And I made fun of when the captain goes down to the landing party, they're like, you need an armed guard. And the number two goes. I'm like, why is that person? Don't they have Marines in Trek? But no, seriously, don't they don't. They apparently, maybe they do, maybe they don't.
But they have time, security personnel, and that's it.
I guess,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're not tromping around in big armor with huge, it's like phasers. Everyone's got these little phasers.
Exactly. You know? They might bring the longer phaser.
That's the business phaser.
but yeah, they're all in jumpsuits and Next Generation or the same uniforms as everybody else. Yeah.
I thought it was funny comparing their navigational skills with Aubrey. We get the line, that's seamanship, because he takes us hundreds of miles in this big circle and comes up right up behind him in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Huge moment. Horatio Hornblower, right away, he knows exactly when they're going to see the hill with the fort. And everyone's like, wow, nobody could have known that except for Horatio Hornblower.
Mm-hmm. Even he, though, lets off, though, that he's a little bit doubting it. Where he's oh, I sure hope I'm right, because otherwise these guys are going to get pissed.
In each sense, these guys, behind the scenes, are like, I hope this is right, because sailing is hard. Meanwhile, on the Enterprise, I wrote, plot a course for... Because that's what Kirk does. Kirk's like, plot a course for this place, and then he heads into his room to take a shit, and the spaceship basically flies itself there.
Sulu just has a blast.
I think it'd be funny if it took 3 hours to turn the Enterprise.
It has a rudder. You just see it put its shields up, and then it just fires nukes off directly in front of it. Yeah, we'll slow down eventually. We just got to keep shooting these nukes off.
They're all cishet white guys. Two of them are married. Hornblower and Aubrey are married. Kirk is, I said, single and looking to mingle. they're all good fighters. Aubrey, I don't know that there's ever a point made that he's an exceptional fighter, but we spend a lot of time watching him take on lots of people at once and bail people out that are in trouble. We see him get sneak attacked by the cowardly French guy hiding under the thing, but I don't know that we ever see him really, there's no act three moment where the French captain has him leaning over the edge of the ship and it's like, oh no, he's not gonna make it. That never happens, right?
Was he cowardly or did he just know his limitations?
Right. I mean, the movie, I think, is framed. He's standing, this guy's sneaking out from under the thing. In my mind, I'm like, well, that's fighting, man. I don't again, if the point is to kill each other, you just want it to work.
Yeah, sorry. There's no rules. If I got you, then...
However, you do got to put the flag up before you do that in the Navy, in this period we've learned. It's a fun crosscut. It's a small note, but it's worth talking about. Obviously, these are all like out there on the high seas, mm-hmm. like boat action stuff. They're all far away.
Mm-hmm.
They're all far away from home, and that's a component that they have to grapple with at some point or another. You don't want to fall out. You don't want, and if you fall out, you got to get back to the ship. Like getting back to the ship is really important. And we talked about this a little bit with the Apocalypse How batch, if you remember. I think it was in Apocalypse Now where it was like, don't get out of the boat.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you want to stay with the ship. You don't want to fall out. And then the other one that I thought was interesting, just as a storytelling mechanism for cinema, is that interior explosion shot.
Yeah.
Where it's like, if you are far away from somewhere in any kind of ship or anything, then one of the consequences is you're at some point going to be in a little tiny room that will like explode inward on you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Submarines coming to mind here as well. And
oh, God.
Just very morbid contexts. All of this is kind of part of that frontier story that we talk about with the hegemonic masculinity trope that Trujillo talks about, what it means to be on the frontier, to experience the frontier, and what kind of man that you want in charge when those are the stakes and those are the contexts. And all of these movies are very similar in that regard, I think, in terms of how far away we are. Like, what are the biggest distinctions, do you think, meaningful distinctions that you see in terms of just, like, leadership, character, any of those things across these
That's
folks?
What I'm wondering. Like, who would you – here's my question. Yeah. Out of the Real War Project leaders, who would you want to be led by?
Fascinating. Well, it's not that Siege of Jadotville guy because he drives me fucking bonkers. He's got to shut up. I'm looking at the list here. Patton, nope. Do you have an answer, Charles, as I peruse the list? Is President Muffley an option? Oh, no. You know who it's going to be for me? It's going to be the failsafe president. Who was that guy?
His name is Henry Fonda.
There it is. It's Henry Fonda on the phone in a bunker trying to sort it out.
Desperately trying to sort it out, yeah.
But he's the kind of tone. He's the kind of... I don't know. What would you say?
Do you think he would work? He would work out pretty good in Starfleet?
President Henry Fonda in Starfleet in charge mm-hmm. of a ship?
Yeah, if he was a Captain Henry Fonda from there, yeah.
Yeah, seems like it.
What's his name? Larry Hagman would be doing Uhura's job.
And it's interesting, too, to think, like, what kind of leadership characteristics do we see in that character in that movie, and how similar are they to the, quote, natural leader in this one? Obviously, this is just circling back to this critique of, you know, white settler patriarchy and things. But it's not necessarily so simple. And I do think it's an interesting question to be like, of the shows, the movies that we've watched, 39 titles now, like, who are the accountable leaders? Bruce Willis, Tears of the Sun? I'm good. I don't need that guy in charge of my group.
To a certain point, I want to be not in the action, right? Like, McClellan is good to a point because you don't want to be fighting at all, uh-huh. you know, but at the same time, it's like, I also don't want this to go on forever. So at some point, we got to do it.
If you don't want to fight at all and you're up against people that are very literally going to kick your ass, well, then you get your ass kicked. And that's what happened to McClellan. Basically, Robert E. Lee was like, oh, no, we're going to fight, dude. Like, that is literally what we're here
right.
for.
Right. So like at 12 o'clock high, they're saying like, you know, we're trying not to get killed, but at the same time, we're still getting killed. They're fighting right. the McClellan battle.
Right.
And it's like, you've got to take it eventually to them.
Yeah.
To just get this over with, because otherwise
New York sometimes, man, I guess
sometimes you got to nuke New York. You nuke New York. All right.
It's a pun.
So, yeah, because you don't want it to escalate. Like, you're always it's.
I would call that an escalation, but no, it is. It's a weird day. It's a good point, because you can't have a leader that, right, like Starles, dude, how many of your men are you going to get killed? Like, are you ready to kill anyone in your group? Like, what's going on? What are we here for? Not to be a tall fan, but this is kind of the take. I'm looking at the list more. Chris Cooper in Jarhead, no.
No.
Good afternoon, Marines!
Good afternoon, sir!
Ooh, I just felt my dick move.
Chris Cooper in Matewan, yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You say you got guns. Well, I know that you all are brave men. And I know you could shoot it out with the company if you had to. But the coal company don't want this union. The state government don't want it. The federal government don't want it. And they're all of them just waiting for an excuse to come down and crush us to nothing.
I forgot that he's a two-timer. Hell yeah.
Yep, he is. And boy, he's like looking different directions in name when he shows up. These two guys look the same, sound the same, but they have different priorities. And one of them is a wobbly.
Yeah, and the other one is
not
a Marine.
Yeah, I'm looking. We've got Gene Hackman from Behind Enemy Lines calling your son and telling you to put your big boy pants on there.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Pretty good. Yep. It's a fun question. And boy, there's a lot of bad leaders here.
There's a lot of bad, yeah. I don't want Duskull. Yeah.
Right. Most of these batches, I'm like, nope. Paths of Glory, no. Glory, I mean, this version of the guy, yes. But the actual version where he starts talking about the Irish in the letters home, I'm not so sure. I don't know if I want him to be my guy. Yeah. Well, let's see. Any other thoughts on these batches? One of the metaphors that we make, and this comes from, the reason I picked up Language and Symbolic Action today is because in this book, he talks about a famous thought experiment that you riffed on, which is the parlor metaphor. Mm. And we're going to put all these movies in a parlor. We've got 13 batches now, and they're all sitting here looking back at us and saying stuff. Any big picture takeaways, like, across these batches, or just as far as the show is concerned?
I'm always thinking about, like, what the next batch is. You know, I'm looking at the horizon there. And what I've learned from this show is that it's sometimes really disappointing.
Uh-huh. We make ourselves sad a lot.
to realize that something that we really like is questionable in the message that it portrays.
I was just going to really echo what you said in terms of aggregating the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I was editing the Patton episode, and I was thinking about the soldier getting slapped and how we talk about how in Paths of Glory, that person is the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And in Patton, it is the hero. And I just have Kubrick in my imagination standing there being like, yeah, that's what I was trying to say. It's like, look how shitty this person is for doing this. And by the way, U.S. generals have done that. This is something that, yes, they have done. And so it's like you've got this instance where it's like one of the fun things for me about doing this is that, as you know, a lot of these movies I had not seen. And when you see it the first time, it's the first time you see it. And you don't know that there's a genealogy there and like a lineage. And as we start adding titles, that is one of the first takeaways to me that's really starting to stand out is how so much of the storytelling techniques have that lineage. And you can see them going back to various people making various arguments about, you know, true events based on true, yeah, stories and things.
Yeah, it goes back to our conversation with Metz, and that's his whole approach to doing it, is that whether the movie wants to or not, it's always going to be speaking to all of the movies that came before it.
Yep.
And whether you know it or not, when you're making the movie, it is borrowing from the collective alphabet,
yeah,
of all of the other movies. And we're seeing, like, really how much, I mean, how many, after a while, like when we get to 100 movies or so, yeah, we're going to be wondering, well, what other kind of war story can you tell?
Right.
And that's really the question, is what is the war story that you should be telling?
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't be maybe the Master and Commander one, as much as we really like Master and Commander. Maybe the lesson that we take away from that is wrong. With Patton and the guy from Paths of Glory, you know, it's the same situation. You're supposed to say, I mean, I don't think that you're supposed to side with Patton in the scene.
No,
they
they make him into a monster in the movie. They do. And his apology is bullshit. And I think the movie wants you to think that, but mm-hmm. there's plenty of room to accept his explanation.
Yeah. Yeah. The movie, but Paths of Glory was very explicit in that one moment where it's like, this guy doesn't see the combat. What's he doing telling the other guy that he's a coward?
Paths of Glory, like I did the first episode, you know, it's like I saw a movie that I thought was wrestling with war, and I'm like, this is a pretty good anti-war movie. I thought there were some glamorous charge moments and that he was too good of a soldier and all of that. We can listen to the episode and all this. But what never really stood out to me until we go further on, and this is true for The Thin Red Line too, which is another one we haven't done yet, but we will at some point, is how explicitly it's taking some of these moments in these movies and turning them on their head.
Yeah.
And instead of making it someone we would celebrate, we turn it into someone that we hate. The other moment that comes up is when Patton threatens to remove the guy from command if he doesn't lead this charge. And the guy's I guess I'm going to freaking do it. And in Paths of Glory, when that happens, it's unconscionable.
Yeah, he does the
and
same what, thing, yeah.
It's what turns that guy around. Yeah, and we see it too, you know, in another instance, I think. And Paths of Glory is one of the only ones where we really see the gravity of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we see it again in The Thin Red Line when Starles is removed and those contexts. But I don't know. I feel like Paths of Glory, at least for me, has really stood out as speaking to this kind of genealogy. The second thing I really want to take away from like why I'm happy we're doing this project is that those weird things that you do to kind of throw a zinger in there, like they work. Batches 8 and 9 are the two batches that I think we have one of the most fascinating conversations about, quote, better war stories. That includes Dawn of Planet of the Apes. And this was a movie that was like, okay, we're going to watch this movie for a war show. And we had a great episode and also learned a lot about, you know, the war imagination from that movie. The other moment that this really sings and will continue to work is at the end of last season, Batch 11, Day of Days. We watched Overlord from 1975 and Overlord from 2018. And they are both about Normandy, Charles. And there is a point at which it is so absurd how different they are. And there is a point at which it is deeply fascinating to look at the two versions of this story that exist. How popular the, quote, zombie computer game version is.
Yeah.
How few people have ever heard of Overlord 1975, which is a tragedy.
Yeah, no, it's truly bizarre because after a certain point, video games get so good that graphics-wise, that they sort of echo chamber onto each other.
Yep.
And that's the whack part of the thing where you're like, ooh, you too can be a 101st Airborne soldier and you can go and you can be the hero of Call of Duty. And that's the problem with Call of Duty, among other things, is that it posits a world where you're the guy who makes it all the way to the end, as opposed to playing a game like Hell Let Loose, where I just get fucking plinked and my life was thrown away so incredibly easy and in the most ignominious manner.
Yeah.
And that one doesn't make me feel like it's fun to play the game. But it doesn't make me ever feel like I'm a one-man army. No, it makes me feel like I should just crawl everywhere.
Just don't move and wait for it to be over. I don't know. That's kind of my tack. The thing that did get me with Medal of Honor, and it is funny, and I think other people probably did this, is the very first time I played that game, I remember being like, I'm going to see if I can actually survive. And of course, you don't. You get killed pretty early on because, you know, your computer game, you don't know how to play it and all this. And also, the first time you hit a beach, you just don't really know what to do. There's just a lot of randomness that goes into it. And that was a moment where I was like, oh shit, so I'm just this dead soldier on the beach. That's where I died. And yeah, this is totally what would have happened. And that's my lesson. And that's what I, but instead it's like, you know, refresh and do it again and refresh and realize the machine gun just is on a pattern. And there's nothing, you know, pretty soon you just hack that and go. The longest day in that batch is interesting because it doesn't really presume this. It presumes a lot of people get killed and die, but we just, it's an officer movie, we said, so we're just not that sad about it. We just kind of, we're sad about it when John Wayne wants to get the guys out of the tree or whatever, but the end of the movie whistling off the beach with this lone helmet sitting in the sand, it's just a weird takeaway. It ain't immortality, but it's not like real, like introspection, you know.
No, and Longest Day was surprisingly good. I mean, we did like it, but it's at the end, it's like, and we're gonna go on to win.
Yep,
it's like the end of they'll keep fighting and they'll win at the end of Starship Troopers.
Exactly right. Again, I feel like Captain Horatio Hornblower has a lot of similar kind of like dated vibes to it,
but it's a dated movie.
Right. That's the, I mean, it is. It's 1951 as opposed to 1962. And to put those two movies in the same conversation is saying a lot about Horatio Hornblower there. Like, the miniatures look great. Like, those ships looked really good. It was
so much fun.
Yeah, it was very, very
cool. The fact that every time, like, a huge amount of rigging fell down and guys, like, had to stop what they're doing and just start axing rope out of the way so that they can do anything because it's just, like, a huge net.
Yeah.
Like, a net that weighs a lot because it's a huge rope.
Yeah. I mean, some of those ropes are thicker than your arm, thicker than your... They're lines, I hear sailors out there. They're not ropes. They're lines. Fine.
Well, all that string that goes in between the sails and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It brought around things that I just never really thought about before. How easily you'd have to, back then, transition to fighting on land.
Yeah,
right. is strange. Purposely sinking a ship and all the guys just swimming to shore. The weird gentlemanly rules that only exist between incredibly rich aristocracy in their games of war.
Yeah,
is totally whack.
It's so weird. Like, it's very weird to think that there's one commander of an aircraft carrier or something like that. Like, that's weird that there's one person that's in charge of that vehicle. But that's not really how that works, at least not in the contemporary sense. Like, if that person were to be like, let's go over here now, it just wouldn't last very long, right? Like, that person would be relieved from their command all this. At this point in time, you are literally putting one person in charge of, like, 300 people, and they can do whatever the fuck they want. And the moment where Crow and the other captain are looking at each other through their telescopes is that weird aristocracy moment where it's like, it's just you and me out here, and don't cheat and be a gentleman. And also, here comes a ton of lead.
Yeah, if you get killed in the cannon exchange, then so be it.
Right.
But if we're sword fighting, whoever gets their arm cut first,
that's
whoever
it.
Calls, yeah, then we got to stop. We can just tell them to stop, like, oh, I'm hurt.
Let's stop. That's it. It's over. All right. I'm out. It's paintball rules. You put your hands up and you go, okay, I'm out. You got me.
Hold the gun over your head.
Yep. All okay. Right. And then you take three more shots because your friends are jerks. Yeah. Okay. Again, the batches. We saw formative war films. Nuclear Annihilation was batch 2. Afghanistan, batch 3. Star Wars Cultures was fun and worth revisiting. I felt like Horatio Hornblower talked to Star Wars. Children of War, Batch 5, Apocalypse How, Batch 6, Spectacles of Slaughter, Batch 7, 8 is Boiling Points, 9 Taking Sides, 10 A Crew of Specialists, 11 Overlord, 12 You Are Already Dead, 13 A Natural Leader, or if you like, Boat Action. Either one of these work for me. For Season 2, we're going to do 4 batches, which means at the end of this next batch, we'll be halfway through Season 2.
Oh, hot that? Dog.
Yeah.
I hate the thought of it. I just want to keep doing batches constantly all the time.
I know. Well, the good news is I don't think we're going to run out of movies.
Cool.
That's it. There's no more war movies.
We are going to head to 1987.
Mm.
We're going to see a very young Don Cheadle. We're going to see a young Dylan McDermott. Oh, Steven Weber from Wings. Very exciting, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. We're watching the Vietnam War film Hamburger Hill.
In this dirty old part of the city,
if you want to walk out of this place, sun refused to shine. You will listen to people who know. You be an individual, and I'll be tagging your ugly, toothless face straight on its way to a long box with metal handles.
Strangers to the land.
This was a movie that was on television a lot when I was growing up.
The tagline is war at its worst, men at their best.
It should be really, really, really sweaty. I haven't seen this movie in 2 decades.
Okay. Yeah, we haven't. Yeah. The last Vietnam movie we watched was Batch 6, The Apocalypse How. We saw Full Metal Jacket and Apocalypse Now.
We got to get out of the air and out of these boats and get into some real war project.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm going to point my cannon right here at the floor of my little boat here and sink it right in the harbor.
There you go. Well, I'm sick and tired of going nowhere, so I'm just going to take this cannonball and jump into the lake and see what happens.
Nice.
See you later.
Thank you. I'm a good leader. He's a mighty good leader. He's a mighty good leader. All the way.
Okay, kiddo, I lost my library of sound, so I need you to do some sound effects for me.
I don't want to do this, Dad.
Look, I'm just trying to put food on the table, but if you don't want to help...
All right.
Here Biggs chronicle a galaxy of genre. Listen to the deconstruction of film on A Cosmic Void. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. Finally, a podcast that's dedicated to talking about your favorite sports movies. Whether you want to hear a breakdown of the plot, arguments about who's the MVP of the film, or crit and lit about it, you'll find it all on Fields of Glory. Listen to the show that will help you have a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in the podcast, Living With Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two horror enthusiasts of varying experience discussing horror movies through the scope of content, context, and comedy. They'll hit on the good ones and the classics, but they're really excited for the bad ones. Listen to Watch No Evil. You can find all of Redwood Sound Lab shows at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.